Part 5. 22. Access of Enablers. The deal was done. After days of maneuvering at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House announced on December 18th that President Trump planned to sign a spending compromise to keep the government funded for 2 months. He would punt into the new year his fight with congressional Democrats over border wall funding. Convinced that there were not enough votes in the House to secure $5.7 billion for the wall, Trump had bowed to political reality. This was a rare concession from a president accustomed to sparring until he got his way. His retreat averted a government shutdown over Christmas, a prospect Republican leaders universally regarded as a political loser, one easily branded the Trump shutdown, thanks to the president's eagerness to own it in his earlier meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. As he celebrated the agreement to avoid a shutdown, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters, "You remember my favorite country saying, 'There's no education in the second kick of a mule.' We've been down this path before, and I don't believe we'll go down this path again." When Trump tuned in to conservative media, he faced a full-scale rebellion. Rush Limbaugh told his millions of radio listeners, "Trump gets nothing, and the Democrats get everything." Ann Coulter published a column titled, "Gutless President in Wallless Country," and predicted in a podcast that Trump's tenure will go down in history as a joke presidency. Even on the curved white couch of Fox and Friends, a cradle of Trump sycophancy each morning, the host, Brian Kilmeade, chided him over the compromise spending bill. Congressman Mark Meadows and other members of the House Freedom Caucus joined in the howls of indignation, warning Trump personally and in media appearances that he was being led astray. They implored the president to reject the terms, demand his proposed $5.7 billion in wall funding, and force a government shutdown if that's what it took. At the White House, Trump was in a tailspin as he absorbed the convulsions within his political base. On December 20th, with just 1 day until the government funding deadline, Trump threatened to veto the compromise bill unless it included wall funding. The president's sudden shift torpedoed the deal negotiated earlier in the week. At the end of December 21st, funding for numerous agencies expired, shutting down large parts of the federal government, halting numerous services, and sending close to 400,000 workers home without pay indefinitely. Trump dug in and vowed not to budge until Democrats agreed to fund wall construction. The president warned that the shutdown could last a very long time. Do we succumb to tyranny of radio talk show hosts? We have two talk radio hosts who influenced the president. That's tyranny, isn't it? An exasperated Bob Corker, who was retiring from the Senate, told reporters at the Capitol, "This is a juvenile place we find ourselves. The reason we're here is that we have a couple talk radio hosts that get the president spun up." Plunging into a government shutdown just before Christmas with no plan to reopen it was classic Trump. It was a decision made in duress. It was a suicide mission, one of Trump's former White House advisors said. There was no off-ramp. There was no way the Democrats would just back down. There was no way to win. It was done based on impulse and emotion and dogmatism and a visceral reaction rather than a strategic calculation. That's indicative of a lot of the presidency and who he is. Trump canceled his holiday vacation plans, staying at the White House in light of the government shutdown, while Melania and Barron flew to sunny Palm Beach to hang out at Mar-a-Lago. Marooned for the pre-Christmas weekend at the White House, Trump watched hours of cable news and stewed over the coverage, not only of the shutdown, but also of Mattis's resignation. Mattis's letter, distributed to reporters by his aides, was interpreted in the media as a scathing rebuke of Trump's worldview. Trump's anger reached a boiling point early on the morning of December 23rd. At 9 a.m. in Washington, he called Patrick Shanahan, who was then in Seattle, where it was 6 a.m. Shanahan was preparing to depart for a family vacation to Mexico over Christmas. Trump told him he wanted him to be his new defense secretary, starting immediately, and complained about Mattis's attack letter. Shanahan defended Mattis, but also pleaded with Trump to allow the gargantuan Defense Department a more reasonable transition period. Shanahan often said he had gotten a Ph.D. in foreign policy watching Mattis, and he wanted to ask him more critical questions before he left. Trump grudgingly agreed Mattis could stay, but only until December 31st. Shanahan canceled his trip and flew back to Washington. That same morning, Sweeney warned Mattis's staff, "Anticipate the tweet." Mattis had just received a phone call from Mike Pompeo, who said the president was abruptly forcing him out. Trump was removing the defense secretary 2 months ahead of schedule, only he was apparently too afraid to tell Mattis himself, so he made the secretary of state call him instead. Administration officials said Trump was retaliating against the negative news coverage, which he baselessly suspected Mattis had helped stoke. Trump's tweet arrived at 11:46 a.m., announcing that Patrick Shanahan, who was Mattis's number two, and for many years prior was an executive at Boeing, one of the largest defense contractors, would become acting defense secretary. As happened with just about everybody in Trump's orbit, the invisible clock had run out. Late in 2018, Trump was complaining about Mattis to friends. He told one, "Mad Dog. That's not the perfect nickname for him because he's not aggressive enough. He's not assertive enough. He didn't really earn that nickname." At the Pentagon that day, a young Marine who often worked at the security station guarding the Potomac River entrance, which Mattis and his staff used to enter the building, threw his phone down on the pavement when he read the news that Trump was removing Mattis early. "Marines don't forget," the guard said. Marines revered Mattis, and the guard was no exception. The general had earned his reputation the slow and steady way. A bachelor who never married, the commander made it a tradition that he would volunteer to take a junior officer's shift on Christmas Day so his subordinates could spend the holiday with their families. Trump's treatment of Mattis upset the secretary's staff. They decided to arrange the biggest clap-out they could. The event was a tradition for all departing secretaries. They wanted a line of Pentagon personnel that stretched for a mile, applauding Mattis as he left the Pentagon for the last time as secretary. It was going to be huge, staffers joked, borrowing from Trump's glossary. But Mattis would not allow it. "No, we're not doing that," he told his aides. "You don't understand the president. I work with him. You don't know him like I do. He will take it out on Shanahan and Dunford." On his last day, New Year's Eve, Mattis left the Pentagon without public fanfare. He was hoping to protect the men he left behind, including Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Joseph Dunford. He did record an audio farewell message to Defense Department employees, which he began by quoting from a telegram President Lincoln sent to General Ulysses Grant in 1865. "Let nothing which is transpiring change, hinder, or delay your military movements or plans. I am confident that each of you remains undistracted from our sworn mission to support and defend the Constitution while protecting our way of life," Mattis told the employees. "Our department is proven to be at its best when the times are most difficult." In the weeks that followed, Trump's remaining national security advisors, buttressed by the pleas of foreign leaders and Republican allies on Capitol Hill, engaged in a tug-of-war with the president to reverse or alter his decision to withdraw from Syria. As was often the case with his rash decisions, Trump would ultimately backtrack. A contingency force of U.S. troops would remain in Syria for many months to come. Christmas Eve was Trump's third straight day holed up inside the White House during the partial federal government shutdown, and his grievances billowed out to form a heavy cloud of Yuletide gloom. All morning on December 24th, the president barked out frustrations on Twitter. "Democrats are hypocrites. The media make up stories. The Federal Reserve chairman is like a golfer who can't putt. Senators are wrong on foreign policy, and so is Mattis." Trump's 10th tweet of the day at 12:32 p.m. was a plaintive complaint that landed like a cry for help. "I am all alone, poor me, in the White House, waiting for the Democrats to come back and make a deal on desperately needed border security," he wrote. The night of Christmas Eve, Trump made his first public appearance since the government closed. He and the First Lady, who had flown back from Florida for the occasion, participated in an annual presidential tradition, a photo opportunity tracking Santa Claus on military radar. The couple sat in armchairs near a crackling fire in the state dining room, which was cleared of furniture save for two Christmas trees. They talked into separate phones with children calling in as part of the North American Aerospace Defense Command's Santa Tracker. Trump risked blowing Santa's cover when he was patched through to a 7-year-old girl, Coleman Lloyd, calling from her home in South Carolina.
"Are you still a believer in Santa?" Trump asked.
"Yes, sir," Lloyd replied.
"Because at 7, that's marginal, right?" the president said.
Lloyd later told the Post and Courier that she had never heard the word marginal before. On December 26th, at 12:06 a.m., in the dark of night, Trump took off from Joint Base Andrews on a secret mission to Iraq, his first visit to a conflict zone as commander-in-chief. Rallying U.S. service members at al-Assad Air Base west of Baghdad, Trump amplified his call to draw down America's presence in foreign wars and, at a moment of leadership turmoil at the Pentagon, asserted his personal influence over the military.
"We're no longer the suckers, folks," Trump declared. "The United States cannot continue to be the policeman of the world."
Trump broke norms in his speech to the troops. He criticized their commanders for failing to meet his deadlines to withdraw from Syria and other conflicts. He told a number of falsehoods, including that troops had not received a raise in more than 10 years until he recently authorized a 10% raise. In fact, troops had received raises every year for decades, and the one Trump authorized was 2.6%. Trump also jeopardized the neutrality Mattis strove to maintain by making his event with troops overtly political. He attacked Pelosi by name for her party's refusal to fund construction of a border wall and signed Make America Great Again caps. And he imported the signature stagecraft of his campaign rallies to Iraq, entering to Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA and exiting to the Rolling Stones's You Can't Always Get What You Want. Trump enjoyed playing the role of commander-in-chief, zipping up his bomber jacket, giving orders to generals, saluting officers in uniform. On his visit to Iraq, he sounded awestruck by the stealthy safety requirements of war zone travel. "I had concerns for the institution of the presidency," he told reporters traveling with him. "Not for myself, personally. I had concerns for the First Lady, I will tell you. But if you would have seen what we had to go through, with the darkened plane, with all windows closed, with no lights on whatsoever, anywhere, pitch black. I've never seen it. I've been in many airplanes, all types and shapes and sizes. I've never seen anything like it."
Trump began the year 2019 as a president unchained. He had replaced a raft of seasoned advisors who sought to enlighten and restrain him with a cast of enablers who executed his orders and engaged his obsessions. Jim Mattis was replaced by Patrick Shanahan. Don McGahn was replaced by Pat Cipollone. Jeff Sessions was replaced by Bill Barr. John Kelly was replaced by Mick Mulvaney. They saw their mission as telling the president yes. On January 4th, Trump showed he was in charge when he dressed down Mulvaney in front of congressional leaders from both parties during a White House meeting to negotiate a budget compromise to reopen the government. Just as Mulvaney was trying to nail down specifics on border wall funding, Trump interrupted his chief of staff. "You just fucked it all up, Mick," Trump said, according to Axios. The president rebuffed Mulvaney and hit the reset button. Needless to say, there was no deal. The episode, later confirmed by attendees, was stunning and, for Mulvaney, humiliating. It illustrated the limited regard with which Trump held the man he had just entrusted with helming his West Wing, and it diminished him in the eyes of the principals in Congress with whom he would need to regularly negotiate. Mulvaney was no match for Kelly, either in physical presence or in professional experience. Trump liked Mulvaney just fine, but did not afford him the same respect he did his predecessor. Mulvaney was named to the job in an acting capacity, although, unlike Shanahan, he did not require Senate confirmation to hold the position permanently. If Mulvaney was bothered by the diminished title, he didn't let on. Internally, he fashioned himself as a consensus builder. One of his subordinates explained his approach to the job as basic. "Mick just wants to be liked." Mick's inclination is to try to find a way to make the boss's impulses work, no matter how destructive or dangerous Trump's idea might be, a senior administration official said. He'll enable rather than advise and manage, which, in this presidency, is a recipe for disaster. That description belied Mulvaney's opportunism and ambition. A former Tea Party congressman, Mulvaney had his own political ideology, forged years before Trump ran for president. He calculated that by not literally standing guard over the president hour after hour, as Kelly and Priebus had done, and by avoiding palace skirmishes, he could quietly push forward on building a right-wing fiefdom. In the name of Make America Great Again, Mulvaney would pursue his own conservative agenda on fiscal, labor, health care, and other domestic policies. After Pelosi became House Speaker the first week of January, the threat of congressional investigators bearing down on Trump became real. Democratic committee chairmen were readying a vast array of probes, from Trump's efforts to thwart the Russia investigation and his secret communications with Vladimir Putin, to the president's tax returns and bank records, to alleged abuse in the White House security clearance process, and the separation of migrant children from their families at the border. It fell to Cipollone to captain the administration's defense. The conservative former Kirkland and Ellis partner, who was then working at a boutique plaintiff's firm, had several ins to Trump's orbit. He had gotten to know Trump by privately advising the president's legal strategy since the summer of 2018, and Jay Sekulow found his assistance invaluable. The Fox News host, Laura Ingraham, who had been close to Trump for years, also recommended Cipollone. They became close friends when Cipollone helped her through a time of personal struggle over her faith. Cipollone had another great calling card. He was a genuine fan of Trump's policies and was determined to help advance his legislative agenda and put more of Trump's aspirations into the win column. Despite Cipollone's conservatism, he had friends and admirers across the aisle, too. His former co-workers said he had a comfortable, genial style and put people around him quickly at ease. In his cases, he tried to find compromises to move forward. Melanie Sloan, a Trump critic and prominent government ethics lawyer, applauded Trump's choice. She noted that Cipollone had a moral code and predicted that he would be unlikely to cross ethical boundaries in service to the president, despite Trump's frequent demands of advisors to do so. "He will advocate for his client quite zealously, but within the confines of the law," Sloan said. She added, "It's hard for me to imagine Pat doing something that would harm his reputation. He has a pretty strong core." Cipollone officially joined the office in November and spent the next couple of months repopulating the White House counsel's office with warrior lawyers in anticipation of a drawn-out battle with House Democrats over investigations. With McGahn's departure in October, four of the five deputy White House counsels had left, and by late that year, the number of lawyers on staff had dwindled to fewer than 20 from 35. This shrinkage had eroded the ability of the White House to vet policies and personnel and left the administration ill-prepared for the looming oversight fight. But the silver lining for Cipollone was that he had a clean slate to build from. By the beginning of January, Cipollone had hired 17 lawyers, including three new deputies he had handpicked: Patrick Philbin, Kate Comerford Todd, and Mike Purpura. They joined John Eisenberg, a deputy since Trump took office. Each of the three newcomers possessed considerable experience working in the George W. Bush administration, either in the White House counsel's office or in the Justice Department. They were well-versed in executive privilege, the legal topic that Cipollone planned to deploy as both a protective tool and a cudgel in fending off the prying demands of Democratic lawmakers. Cipollone and his team crafted Trump's executive privilege strategy as a means of fending off the expected blizzard of requests from Democratic lawmakers and to protect the confidentiality of the Office of the President. The lawyers were prepared to make a robust argument that White House communications must remain shielded in order for the president to receive full and frank advice from his aides and advisors. They also anticipated blocking congressional subpoenas for testimony from scores of current and former administration officials, citing executive privilege. Meanwhile, Barr was preparing to assume control of the Mueller investigation. Barr's reputation, forged during his first tour as Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush, was that of a devoted institutionalist who cared deeply about protecting Justice Department norms and rising above petty political gamesmanship. The Senate had unanimously approved his nominations for all three of his past Justice Department jobs, a fact Barr quietly reminded friends of. But it was clear to any student of the modern era that his confirmation process to become Trump's attorney general would not be so smooth and that the outcome would not be unanimous. In early January, as he prepared for his Senate confirmation hearings, Barr spent considerable time thinking through what, at least in the near term, his number one job was: handling the conclusion of Mueller's investigation and the release of his expected report. He closely read the special counsel's stated mission and underlying statutes, as well as the Justice Department opinions that constrained how prosecutors could treat the president in an investigation. Barr assumed Mueller and his team would write some sort of report at the end of their investigation, but had not spoken to the special counsel and did not know what form it would take. The special counsel regulations called for the findings to be delivered to the attorney general, but did not require a public report. Rod Rosenstein's plan had long been to keep any such report private. At most, the Justice Department would make a public announcement that a confidential report had been delivered, and the special counsel's office was being disbanded. But over time, the idea of keeping the report private seemed impractical. Rosenstein's deputies would joke about the furor it could cause, not only in the media, but also at the Capitol and the White House. From which side of Pennsylvania Avenue would the pitchforks penetrate the building? One quipped. As Barr met privately with dozens of senators, courtesy calls in the run-up to his confirmation hearings, most of them were adamant that Mueller's findings become public. He decided then that he would have to release the report. By withholding it, the Justice Department could look as if it were hiding something. He rationalized that if it documented criminal wrongdoing, the Attorney General couldn't sit on it. And if the President didn't do anything wrong, the Attorney General ought to tell the American people. More than a year and a half into Mueller's investigation, the body politic needed a cathartic moment. And even if the department didn't release the report, Barr assumed someone would leak it eventually. At his January 15th confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Barr testified, "The country needs a credible resolution of these issues. If confirmed, I will not permit partisan politics, personal interests, or any other improper consideration to interfere with this or any other investigation. I will follow the special counsel regulations scrupulously and in good faith, and on my watch, Bob will be allowed to complete his work. Second, I also believe it is very important that the public and Congress be informed of the results of the special counsel's work. For that reason, my goal will be to provide as much transparency as I can, consistent with the law." Though he could not control the timetable for his confirmation, Barr fully expected Mueller's final decisions and report to land in his lap, as opposed to that of the department's interim caretaker, Matt Whitaker. Whitaker's brief tenure as acting attorney general was not kind to his reputation. He had a frosty relationship with some of the most senior officials in the department, leading to paralysis at times. He suspected colleagues were leaking damaging material about him to reporters. Whitaker craved public adoration, and those who worked with him sensed in him a deep insecurity. He was quiet in internal meetings, striking some attendees as more of an observer than a decision maker. A few administration lawyers shared a private joke about Whitaker, saying he reminded them of the character Mongo from the Mel Brooks comedy Blazing Saddles. Barr compared so favorably to Whitaker on the gravitas measure alone that many Justice Department lawyers suspected Mueller would try to time his report so that he could hand his baby to Barr, his trusted former boss. Mueller considered Barr not only a peer, but also a friend. He had been invited to Barr's daughter's wedding. The Senate would vote on February 14th to confirm Barr, 54-45, and he would be sworn in later that day. Throughout January and into February, the Mueller report was like a mysterious plane, circling the atmosphere undetected by radar, but rumored to be landing sometime soon. Inside the special counsel's offices, which had effectively been hermetically sealed for nearly 2 years, the Mueller opus was taking shape. The special counsel team was divided into two. One group of prosecutors and investigators pursuing Russian interference, the other Trump's obstruction of justice. The teams hashed out drafts of their separate volumes while Mueller and his senior leadership team worked on the report summary. There was considerable haggling over nearly every word, but especially so on the issue of the substantial evidence they had gathered suggesting Trump had obstructed justice, and the Office of Legal Counsel opinion stating that the special counsel could not charge a sitting president. "It was vigorously debated. How do we articulate obstruction?" said one person who talked to multiple members of the team. "How do we conclude what his conduct was? It was spirited." They understood the OLC opinion prohibited them from charging him, but the OLC opinion doesn't say you can't recommend charges.
Some prosecutors felt the evidence was substantial and that they had met the requirements for bringing a prosecution if the subject were not the president. Others felt they were missing hard proof of Trump's intent. Because of the legal opinion prohibiting prosecution of a sitting president, they had not reached a formal conclusion about whether they could bring a case. They argued the special counsel should make the gravity of Trump's actions more clear to Congress, which was empowered to pursue impeachment and, ultimately, to the public. "The debate was more spirited," said the person who talked to multiple team members. "Did it ever get angry? Did anyone get short? Yes, but that is business as usual. That does not mean that it is contentious necessarily. This is how these things go when you have 19 lawyers debating how to handle something." Inside Trump's camp, meanwhile, Giuliani, Sekulow, and the Raskins were convinced that Mueller could never make a case for conspiracy between the president and any Russians. They had read every document. They had modest readouts of most of the special counsel's witness interviews. And nothing they saw or heard suggested that Trump knew in advance about the illegal hacking of Democratic emails or urged it, despite his public plea, "Russia, if you're listening," to release Hillary Clinton's deleted emails. The only thing that gnawed at Trump's lawyers was the possibility that there were U.S. intelligence intercepts or foreign intelligence reports that found a link between a Trump campaign aide or associate and a Russian discussing the central crime of hacking Democratic emails. Trump's lawyers believed the president was more vulnerable on obstruction. The worst-case scenario, they were warned by Flood, was that Mueller's report stated that investigators had enough evidence to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the president had committed a certain number of specific federal crimes, but that the special counsel did not indict him solely because of the Justice Department policy forbidding prosecution of a sitting president. That would be tantamount to calling Trump a criminal who was walking around scot-free, out on a technicality. The president's lawyers were drafting their own rebuttal report to issue in the event that Mueller leveled such an accusation. A short version was about 10 pages. The longest version ran as high as 85 pages. That longer version rebutted all the legal positions that Trump's team figured Mueller would have to take to conclude the president committed the crime of obstruction, ignoring his broad powers to fire subordinates and exert his executive authority over the Justice Department. The rebuttal report draft also documented what the Trump lawyers argued was political bias in the FBI's handling of the probe. That included what the Justice Department's Inspector General found to be a worrisome willingness to take official action on the part of some FBI investigators to hurt Trump's chances of election. Exhibit A in the lawyer's trove of evidence were the text messages that the then senior FBI agent Peter Strzok, one of Mueller's original team members, exchanged with the then FBI lawyer Lisa Page. The two were having an affair and, prior to Mueller's appointment, were at the forefront of the FBI's Trump-Russia probe. "He's not ever going to become president, right? Right?" Page wrote to Strzok in one message while they were in the middle of deciding on launching an investigation of Trump and his campaign in August 2016. "No, no, he's not. We'll stop it," Strzok responded. Strzok and Page had now become lead characters in Trump's witch hunt plot, with recurring roles on the president's Twitter feed and on Fox shows. As Trump tweeted on January 12th, for instance, "Lion James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter S. and his lover, Agent Lisa Page, and more, all disgraced and or fired and caught in the act. These are just some of the losers that tried to do a number on your president. Part of the witch hunt. Remember the insurance policy? This is it."
Another recurring character of the drama was Giuliani, the public face of Trump's defense. Though never regarded for his eloquence or precision with language on television, Giuliani unspooled a dizzying string of soundbites in mid-January that required substantial cleanup and rankled other Trump advisors. Giuliani gave divergent accounts of when conversations about developing a Trump Tower project in Moscow occurred. He first said they occurred throughout the 2016 campaign, then said they were hypothetical altogether, then said they might have gone on for the entirety of the campaign, and then said they ended around January 2016, just before the Iowa caucuses. Then there was the matter of the Michael Cohen tapes. Giuliani claimed to have listened to recordings that showed Trump had not instructed his personal attorney to lie to Congress about the Moscow project. Then said he should never have mentioned the tapes at all. Then said such a conversation would have been perfectly normal. Then said he wasn't sure whether they had spoken, before claiming, finally, that they definitely had not. On January 23rd, Giuliani tried to explain his various statements and clarifications by telling The Washington Post's Josh Dossie, "There is a strategy. The strategy will become apparent." Then he pleaded with Dossie, "You have to be patient." Trump was not a patient man, however. The president, who has made more than his share of whoppers, complained about Giuliani to one of his political advisers. "He's the only guy in the world who's less prepared than I am," Trump said. "Rudy goes on TV and doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about." For the next several days, Giuliani stopped appearing on TV. Trump temporarily benched his lawyer. By its 35th straight day, the government shutdown that Trump had said he would be proud to instigate was wreaking havoc across the country. The nation's air travel was in chaos. Federal workers were lining up at food banks. Some Republican senators were in open revolt. Even Christopher Wray, Trump's handpicked FBI director, was decrying the dysfunction. "It takes a lot to get me angry, but I'm about as angry as I've been in a long, long time," Wray said in a video message to FBI employees. "I'm not a loser," the president said. "I'm not going to lose this. I'm not going to look weak. I'm not going to give in." But on January 25th, Trump gave in. The master dealmaker wasn't the wizard he claimed. "It's like McDonald's not being able to make a hamburger," the Republican strategist Mike Murphy said. Trump cast about for someone to blame and pointed fingers at two staffers who led the negotiations on Capitol Hill, Mulvaney and Jared Kushner. During the shutdown, Kushner claimed his bipartisan victory in reforming criminal sentencing law as evidence that he could execute a grand bargain around wall funding and broader immigration changes. Another senior administration official recalled of Kushner, "He kind of said, 'This is how we made the donuts last month, and this is how we'll make donuts again this month, because they were really delicious donuts. We made them well, and it worked. So let's use the same recipe.'" But it was naive to think Democrats like Senator Dick Durbin, who had been willing to support a bill reducing recidivism, would ever agree to fund Trump's wall. Trump did not give up on the wall, however. He reopened the government only temporarily, giving Congress 3 weeks to pass a longer-term budget. During that period, as a 17-member bipartisan panel of lawmakers negotiated a spending compromise, Cipollone, Mulvaney, and other officials devised a drastic plan for Trump to build his wall. The president would declare a national emergency at the southern border, which would trigger extraordinary powers to redirect taxpayer money. On February 15th, Trump signed the new budget agreement, which contained $1.375 billion for fencing and other border expenditures, far less than the $5.7 billion Trump had sought, and formally declared the national emergency. He used the word invasion 7 times to describe the migration patterns at the border. "We're talking about an invasion of our country with drugs, with human traffickers, with all types of criminals and gangs," Trump said. At the Pentagon around this time, Shanahan considered gradually withdrawing the troops Trump deployed to the border shortly before the November 2018 elections, but he quickly realized he would not last very long if he did. After all, Shanahan was acting, and Trump liked it that way. He was more vulnerable to the president's pressure. "He gets to lord it over them," explained one senior administration official. Shanahan was left shaky in his interim position. It was clear that Trump would never nominate him as the permanent Secretary of Defense unless he played ball. So on February 22nd, the Pentagon announced it would increase the number of military personnel on the border by 1,000, bringing the total number of troops to 6,000. Their primary orders were to string concertina wire along the border and install detection systems to secure remote areas between official entry points. This decision tended to confirm the doubts within the Pentagon that Shanahan would not be able to fill Mattis's shoes. Officials noticed that he liked to bring Dunford, or Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army Mark Milley, to any substantive meetings, leaning on their expertise as a crutch. Shanahan wasn't trying to pretend he had Mattis's credentials. He knew he was the accidental secretary, thanks to Trump's vicissitudes, and had no problem admitting what he didn't know. Still, he had critics inside who yearned for someone with Mattis's grounding. "He likes the red carpet," one military official said of Shanahan, "but he can't stand up to Trump. He doesn't have the credibility and experience to say, 'Hey, this is why you shouldn't do that.'" After 2 years of being told no by Mattis, Trump considered Shanahan precisely the kind of replacement he had in mind.